Our second case for argument this morning is the United States v. Guidry. Ms. Christensen.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court.
This is not your initial appearance, I understand.
It is not. It is not. I was just asking earlier if there was an award for number of appearances. But I guess not. May it please the Court. I represent Mr. Guidry in this case. We have two issues, a traffic stop and then sentencing issues.
And let me, before you start, we tried to get a copy of the dog sniff video, and two of them didn't work. Do you know, is there a good copy anywhere?
I personally have a copy. I'm assuming the government has a copy. Okay. We'll make sure the court gets
right.
One.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Should we just submit it as a filing or?
No, that's fine.
Yeah, that's fine. It's okay. Just that the two
didn't
copies
work.
That are in the record.
Well, that's unfortunate.
Yeah,
I have a copy that works,
okay.
But we'll get one.
All right, thanks.
I'll start with the traffic stop and the dog. In this case, we have an officer who was bent on finding something in Mr. Guidry's car and expanded the traffic stop beyond the purpose of the initial stop, which was the license plate violation. He expanded the scope by calling for the canine. And under Rodriguez, this must be supported by reasonable suspicion to expand the scope of the stop. The government argues that there was reasonable suspicion based on three factors. One is the faint smell of marijuana. I think that one can be easily dismissed because Officer Fickett said he couldn't tell where it was coming from. It was a busy road with high winds. The second is the CID report that Mr. Guidry might have been involved in either selling or doing drugs. It's very vague. Exactly what he was involved with. And then the final one is that some weeks prior, Fickett had stopped Mr. Guidry and searched the car based on a strong smell of marijuana, but actually found nothing. I think none of that rises to the level of reasonable suspicion. The government makes the argument that under Childs, this stop occurred before Rodriguez, of course, under Childs, that this was a good faith reliance by the officers on Childs. And I have two responses to that. One is that perhaps it's time for this court to reconsider Childs, although I recognize that Childs was an en banc decision and this panel cannot overrule. But I do have to address that issue to this panel prior to asking for en banc, so we might get there. My second response to the Childs argument is that Childs is a different scenario. Childs involved an officer asking questions of the defendant that were unrelated to the reason for the stop, and questions that the defendant could have refused to answer. I believe the question is whether he had any drugs on him. In this case, the officer called for a dog and to do a sniff around the car, and Mr. Guidry could not refuse that action by the officer, and in fact tried to and was denied. The next issue then.
So let me ask you this, because that the dog came within 5 minutes, right, of
right.
The stop. So we don't have that extended time
no.
frame here.
No. And the argument we're making is that Rodriguez talks about time and scope of the initial stop. So time, it was very quick. You know, I think that there are cases kind of all over the place about time, but I don't think we'd have a standing on that alone prior to Rodriguez. But Rodriguez talks about scope as well. And this expanded the scope without, in our view, reasonable suspicion. Now, this court has recently held in Sanford that expanding the scope can be based on reasonable suspicion. We acknowledge that, but argue that there was none in this case.
Well, let me ask you, if Guidry had left his car without the police hands-up instruction, but still failed to shut his door, would the dog sniff have been impermissible?
I'm sorry. Okay, so if he had...
Guidry leaves his car without the police hands-up instruction.
Oh.
Okay. But he still failed to close his door. Would the dog sniff have been impermissible? I'm trying to get to the scope of the officer and
right.
what he's able to do and not do under your view.
Right. Well, the dog sniff itself around the car is permissible under Caballes. We're arguing that the door and then the dog going in the door went too far into a constitutionally protected space.
So do you think Officer Hamilton had an affirmative duty to close the door or ask Guidry whether he wanted it closed?
I think that leaving the door open, maybe not an affirmative duty, but leaving the door open expanded the search from a Cabalas-type search to one that is into more of a Florida versus Jardine search. I realize that's a curtilage case, but it's still a constitutionally protected area, as is the internal part of the car. I think it is crucial in this case that Mr. Guidry was ordered to have his hands up and could not have turned to shut his door without the officers taking some sort of action against him. I think that we live in a culture where someone has been fumbling with papers, admittedly, has to be ordered to get out of the car, has his hands up, and then if he does something else, I think that he would be subject to immediate arrest at that point for either attempted getting a weapon or hiding evidence of some sort.
How about the window being open?
The window being open? I think there are cases that talk about the window being open when there's a car search, and the officer who had the canine actually discussed that sometimes that occurs. In this case, it's the dog actually putting its head in. And
you could do that through a window?
They could have. I think that still would be a problem.
Okay.
Because when you look at the Tenth Circuit's Winningham case, the dog jumped in the van, and they had an officer.
Dogs do that, you know.
Dogs do that. And that's my problem with the instinctual element of some of these cases, is dogs are primarily instinctually driven animals, even well-trained dogs. So, but it doesn't matter how far the dog gets into the car. The issue is their nose, because that's the reason they're there in the first place. So his nose is in, and I think that's enough to turn that into a search. So unless the court has further questions, I definitely want to move on to the sentencing issues in this case. I'll start with the cross-reference from 2G1.1 to 2A3.1. And it can be based on several different criminal sections, 2241 or 2242. In this case, it's pretty clear from the record that the probation officer was recommending it based on 2242, which requires, as relevant to this case, threatening or placing a victim in fear. The question is fear. We have compounding problems. One is that fear is hard to define, can be very broad, and that the district court didn't make findings about what type of fear was found in this case. Fear of what? A fear of harm to oneself, I think under Cherry, that's enough. But fear of loss of a romantic relationship, what the district court talks about, or fear of loss of a heroin supply or loss of money, I don't think that's enough fear to justify the cross-reference in this case. The court does talk a little bit about the incidences with other women and dragging them from cabs and harming them in that way. One of the victims in this case that was the counts were based on did know about the incident in the summer of 2012 and had heard about the injuries that woman suffered. And that could have very well justified the cross-reference in that victim's case. Each victim had a separate calculation. But the judge didn't make those findings, just said that she knew about it, didn't say that she was fearful necessarily of it happening to her. And to put a possibly too fine point on it, that Mr. Guidry had this incident with someone who he considered a girlfriend who was not prostituting for him. And that might have been a line that the district court could find, but did not. The court did rely a little bit on the size difference between Mr. Guidry and the women who were victims. And as discussed at length in our briefs, that cannot be enough to justify the cross-reference. As I cited in our reply brief, most sex offenses that are prosecuted are male defendants against female victims. And in almost every case, that might be a size difference between the defendant and the victim. I think in most types of cases, when there's an assault or battery, there's a size difference between the two. Not many people would choose to attack someone who's much larger than them.
Now, did Detective Remington testify that all three women said they feared him? They feared that if they didn't do what he said, that he might physically harm them, and they didn't want to cross him.
I know she testified about AR, who was the earlier victim in time. That she was still quite damaged, you know, and fearful of him even now. One of them at the end of the interview with Detective Remington said that she still loved him. And of course, we can talk about that relationship of abuse and love, but I'm not sure that that was enough to warrant the cross-reference.
And you don't think their fear of withdrawal if they didn't have heroin, which, you know, that withdrawal is a terrible thing
sure.
to go through.
Yeah,
you didn't think that was enough.
No, I don't believe that's enough. I think, and that goes into our vulnerable victim argument as well, is that drug addiction is not enough, either for the fear, because all of these women could have found drugs other places. There are other people who deal heroin, and particularly, as this court may have noted, it's an epidemic. And that simple fear of withdrawal from his heroin is not enough. It's not enough in the vulnerable victim. It was only applied in M.M.'s case, not in the others, even though all of them used. And
Ms. Christensen, haven't we said in the past, putting aside size difference, mm-hmm. that the issue of power, broadly construed, is a factor to be considered? And isn't this kind of a classic situation of power?
I don't know particularly the case, but I think...
Well, I was thinking we have a 1998 case where we say fear has a very broad definition, and particularly a disparity in power between the defendant and the victim.
Right. Yes, this court has called it very broad. I think, again, there's always going to be the disparity in power.
Well, but I mean in this unfortunate kind of relationships
right.
that the defendant participated in.
Right. I think you have a very interesting nature of these relationships that are essentially pimp-prostitute.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you do find that struggle of power, and I don't think it's always the same, though. I don't think it's always the pimp that has all the power in that relationship. That was argued at sentencing somewhat about that these women were not victims until the cops said that they were victims. So that disparity in power is somehow shifted when we talk about who we're prosecuting for which offense. So I agree with you that it's very broad, and I also agree that there might in fact be something in the record, but with the district court not making findings specifically about that, talking more about the relationships and the heroin and the money issue, I think that's a problem.
So are you suggesting that the victim has to know their victim before the police calls them a victim?
No, I think that they actually have to be a victim before the police calls them a victim. And I'm not here saying that prostitutes are not victims, but I think that is not a categorical association that we can make, that every prostitute is a victim of every pimp. So I see that I'm in my rebuttal time. I shall reserve the rest. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Christensen. Mr. Wall.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Joseph Wall. I represent the United States in this case. I've handled this case from indictment through today, wrote the brief, handled the sentencing. Just to start out with, Mr. Guidry was a drug dealer who also sold heroin as part of his products, and came to realize that his female customers, heroin customers, would do anything he said to get their heroin, and he was able to turn a number of them into prostitutes and get additional money that way. That's the backdrop of this case. And with all due respect to my counterpart here, there is always a massive disparity in power between a pimp and a prostitute, especially a pimp who is controlling such an addictive substance as heroin. Starting out with the traffic stop, for three separate reasons, the appellant's attack on the canine sniff has to fail. The first is, you got to look at the magistrate's findings of fact. He made very clear findings of fact in this case. He viewed the video, heard the testimony at the hearing, issued two separate decisions with findings of fact that pretty much mirrored each other. In watching the video, after Officer Fickett, the first officer, approached the car, Officer Fickett smelled a faint smell of marijuana, course, he's out in an open road, an argument that he doesn't know where the smell of marijuana is coming from doesn't make much sense because it's probably not going to be coming from the weeds. But he was being careful. He had previous information about Mr. Guidry. He had previously smelled a strong odor of marijuana on Mr. Guidry's car, and then he had information from apparently the Detective Bureau that Mr. Guidry was either selling or using drugs. So he had those three things going for him. But again, he was careful, and he decided to call in the canine unit. He gets paperwork from Mr. Guidry, goes back to his car, and the canine unit comes in 5 minutes. The backup officer comes 3 minutes later. So we're talking about 8 minutes. During this entire time, as the magistrate found, Officer Fickett is still doing, he's handling the paperwork having to do with this new car that Guidry purchased, the change in Guidry's address, writing up the citation. As Officer Hamilton approaches the car, he needs to get the occupants out of the car for Officer Sager to do the canine sniff. That's protocol. Guidry is argumentative. He's refusing to get out of the car. He's fumbling with paperwork. Officer Hamilton's starting to get worried about, you know, where are your hands? What are you doing? The other two officers come to the car, and at this time, Officer Hamilton orders him to get out of the car, and he says, "Show your hands. Put your hands up." And Guidry does put his hands up, but Guidry uses his hands after that to open the car door, and then he leaves it open. And I don't think there is a duty on the law enforcement officer to stop what he's doing and go back and shut an individual's car door or window. And again, as the magistrate said in this case, if Mr. Guidry was able to use his hands to open the door, certainly he could use his hands to close the door without getting in too much trouble. So the first line of attack here in terms of defending this is that this whole process did not extend the time of the stop and the writing of the ticket. There was no additional time. In fact, by the time they finished the canine sniff, Fickett was still writing the ticket. So we haven't extended the time here at all by this canine search. The second thing is Officer Fickett had reasonable suspicion. I mean, he had three things. He had a strong smell of marijuana in Guidry's car earlier. He had this information from the Detective Bureau, and then he's smelling, you know, a faint smell of marijuana. Well, of course, where is that coming from? As I said earlier, it's not coming from the road. He's standing next to the car. But again, he's being careful. So that puts us into this court's decision in Sanford, where, you know, Rodriguez says you can't dawdle anymore. You can't fool around. You have to get in there and you write the ticket or do whatever you need to do and not prolong that traffic stop unless you have reasonable suspicion or probable cause. And I think Fickett here had reasonable suspicion. I don't think he had probable cause, and that was his concern too, is that he didn't have probable cause. So he brought in the canine unit. But I think with those three things, he has a reasonable suspicion.
Can you move then to the finding in terms of fear, and I guess I want to ask you this question: if AM and MM had possessed, would they have possessed the fear if they had not been drug addicts and dependent on Guidry for access to drugs?
Yeah, I think they would have been anyway. I think it would have fallen under the fear. They were deathly afraid of him. He would yell at them. They called him bipolar. He had a split personality. He would go from very charming to very angry. He didn't physically abuse them. He didn't have to. And that's, again, that is very similar to the pimp-prostitute dynamic, that whole psychological dynamic that I see in these cases with the balance of power, the disparity in power, the pimp controls everything, and they did fear him. He was a big guy. They did hear about the beating of this woman. She was very brutally beaten by Jason Guidry. You have the incident where Amanda R. is dragged out of the cab. The cab driver gives a statement. You know, he still remembers it. He said, it's the only time I've ever called the police in 13 years because it was so violent.
And what was the age difference between MM and Guidry?
These ladies were in their early 20s. I think Mr. Guidry is between 33 and 35 now. So, you know, maybe 10, 12 years. You know, they weren't teenagers. They weren't 16, 17 years old. But, you know, in terms of maturity and all that, you're dealing with some very, to use the word, vulnerable, susceptible, weak people. You know, young ladies like this. You know, they're starting out at zero for him to even be able to do this.
Let me move on then to the release conditions, because the dependent support, risk notification, treatment payment, and alcohol use, we found recently that those conditions are too vague to stand when there's no explanation as to why they're needed or necessary.
Yes, in this case, the appellant has raised four different conditions, but I think, you know, this court has the discretion, you know, regarding supervised release conditions. It's under the CAPS case that just came out last year. Whether to correct an error, if these are errors, it's a matter of discretion. Court has the authority to send the case back. It's not required to do so. As this court said, sentencing hearing is not meant to be a dress rehearsal. You know, in this case, the PSR writer, he's reading your cases, and you know they're all coming back. So what he does is he prepares a second addendum in this case, looking at what the court has been saying up through, you know, this February sentencing here, and he lists 13 conditions and statutory basis, the Seventh Circuit basis, guideline basis for these, gives them to the judge. Judge goes over seven of those in front of Guidry. But, you know, the four that are being complained of here, the first one is supportive dependence. Well, if the court upholds a sentence in this case, that condition is going to be moved. He's not going to have dependence. So now we get three left. So what are we talking about? We're talking about alcohol. There's an inconsistency in kind of like the paperwork. You know, one piece of paper says, well, you can't drink too much, and the other says, yeah, you're not allowed to drink at all. Well, is that a reason to send the case all the way back to the court and have a new sentencing, and who knows what's going to happen? So you've got alcohol. You know, there's an inconsistency in what's being told. When he gets out, whether it's in 5 years or 19 years, I would think that his PO is going to be able to say, you know, use some discretion here and you know, come to a definitive statement.
So let me ask you this. Do you think the prosecutor has any obligation when the district judge doesn't hit certain conditions like here to say, judge, you know, based on what the Seventh Circuit has been doing, I understand why you're doing this, but it might be good if you articulated that on the record?
It would be really helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't do that in this case. I was kind of following the PSR writer. But I was seeing all the cases come back, and I was aware of it. But I thought we had enough because it was in the PSR, and you know, the judge comes out.
But it's just like you point out in your brief, because your position is, look, it takes a lot of attorney time and judicial resources to go back over things that may be inconsequential ultimately, but of course we wouldn't even have to have the paper that's being used to write this if it was raised during the sentencing at the time.
Yeah, you're looking at page 63 of my brief, which
yes.
I think I wrote at 2 in the morning in a little sense of frustration with everything. But I'm
just saying, it could be...
Yeah,
yeah.
Right. Sure, you're right. You're absolutely right. We have an obligation. Again, looking at these, you know, the notify others of a risk, Again, the probation officer can take a look at that and say, well, you're not at risk. And then we get paying costs of treatment. Are we going to send this back because there wasn't adequate findings made as to whether he can pay for sex offender treatment or pay for drug and alcohol treatment? And the court has to remember that Judge Randa granted him that drug program, 500 hours in the prison drug treatment program. So he's going to start out with that behind him.
So, Mr. Wall, if it were sent back for a reconsideration of, let's say, the three conditions you've talked about, that doesn't affect the sentence in the case. And let me ask you, you say you read, as all AUSAs do, I think, our criminal decisions. What will it look like if we say, this one's okay? I mean, what message is it that, I mean, because you say you rely heavily on the PSR, and I understand that, and I also understand the time that's consumed in these hearings, but it is a little difficult when we have a decision that's down, and we say, well, it doesn't apply here, but don't do it over.
You have the discretion to do that. And sometimes I think of things like this as, has it reached a critical mass where, you know, the sentencing is, you know, under that standard. It seriously affects the fairness and integrity
of the sentence. Sure you know, some of our decisions have been driven by a concern that there's just an automatic placement in the PSR of conditions without perhaps tailoring them appropriately.
Yes.
And I'm sure you understand that's our concern.
I do. I don't think you would be sending an inconsistent message in this particular case because of the nature of these four.
And to just follow along, so then if it is, and I'm not calling Judge Randa sloppy at all, but, you know, that is the concern. You know, okay, so maybe there is a condition that really, really counts, and that one gets, you know,
yes. No, I
doesn't get the treatment it's supposed to get.
Yeah.
And I'm just saying it's just a waste of everybody's time for us to continue to see these where the conditions haven't been met when it can very simply be said, particularly by the government. I don't know the defense necessarily has to do it, but by the government to say, Judge, you know, before we conclude, you didn't give us these reasons. Could you put it on the record? You know how the Seventh Circuit is. We need it.
Yes. I agree.
So that's a message you'll convey to your office.
I will, and maybe don't punish my client for my failure to speak up.
It's not as if you have a panel that's unsympathetic to what the job of a U.S. district judge is.
Or assistant U.S. attorneys.
Yeah, well, but we're expected to be better. So,
thank you.
Anything else? Okay, thank you. Have a good day.
Ms. Christensen. I suspect you have a different view of the conditions.
Well, I tried to focus, but I will use my time. Supervised release conditions. I've spent a lot of time talking in the last year about supervised release conditions, not just to this court. I've been training a lot of defense attorneys on this issue. And I think that in the last year, we've seen a little bit of what happened, and this court remembers when Booker was decided. Everybody thought, oh, what are we going to do? Sentencings are going to take forever. We have to have all this mitigation. Oh, no. And everything went back, and for about a year, year and a half, older appeals like this one would also go back, and it was consistent. And then now, 11 years later, we've worked those kinks out. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have a little bit of a sky is falling about the supervised release conditions. Could defense counsel object to them? Absolutely. And when I train defense attorneys, that's what I say. Make an objection. If you don't like it, discuss it with your client, particularly now when across the board all seven districts are informing everyone many times about what the conditions are. Make your objections, because at some point it's going to stop because defense attorneys didn't object. That's true of everything. If we don't object, that forecloses review. But in this case, sentencing was mid-February, so it was 2015. The only published decision that had come out was Thompson. So that was all that the district court had to work with, and perhaps should have gotten rid of these conditions or cleaned them up a little bit based simply on Thompson. But every case since Thompson, with the exception of Armour, has gone back for resentencing, including United States versus Poulin, which was decided on January 5th, where, and you know, I was here on Poulin in December, and defense counsel specifically said, we are not objecting to these conditions. And this court remanded anyway, because they were these vague and overbroad conditions. Now, if the government thinks that the probation officer isn't going to enforce these, then they should be stricken from the judgment. Mm-hmm. If a probation officer doesn't care enough about the condition to enforce it when someone's on supervised release, it shouldn't matter. It shouldn't be there. We shouldn't be subjecting the defendant to that oversight. So unless the court has questions.
No, I just want to underscore what Judge Williams has said, and I'm sure Judge Bauer feels the same way. We try a fair number of cases in the circuit, but we plead a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And there has to be an attention by counsel on both sides. And I'm glad to hear, because I know of your involvement in training, Ms. Christensen. There has to be a message. You mentioned Armour, and obviously I'm familiar with Armour. We're trying to strike a balance here. But there needs to be a focus by the prosecution and the defense bar that the supervised release has now become an incredibly central factor in a police situation. So it's not some little trim on the outside of the of what is the centerpiece. It is often a critical centerpiece. So I'm not lecturing. I'm just trying to give you a sense of what I think the court is at. And where we're trying to go, and I think your book or suggestion of as an analogy has force, but we don't want to wait a long time to get a recognition of what we're trying to say here.
Right. If I may respond, I know
of course.
I'm out of
time. And then I have a comment too. Go ahead. You go ahead.
I think that if I were given my choice of any issue that defense counsel could say nothing about and would be reversed on appeal, this would not have been it. There are issues that are much more important in our clients' minds, search issues, sentencing issues, evidentiary issues, but we are where we are. And our clients do spend a significant amount of time on supervised release. It can be expanded. And in this case, he only got 3 years. It could be expanded to life because that's the statutory maximum. Mm-hmm. I've had clients say to me that they don't want to do supervised release, that they want me to ask the judge to convert that to a sentence. I say, I can't see myself doing that, but it's hard to be on paper. And they realize that, and we're trying to make that transition understandable by all parties.
Yeah, and so I would just say, since Judge Flom mentioned the whole guilty plea situation, let me put in another pitch. We see so many cases where the judge doesn't hit certain things that are required by the statute in the guilty plea.
Oh, yes.
Different things that are not mentioned. Mm-hmm. So that's another place where a lot of paper and time is wasted. Often what's not hit is not so critical that we send it back. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I for the life of me, I don't understand why we are not armed with checklists when we go in with the plea. So if the judge misses a particular right, that the defense says, what about this? Or the prosecutor says, what about this? I mean,
right.
These are fundamental. I mean, I know we're not discussing that now, but since we're in this discussion about looking forward, it would save everybody a lot of time and money and energy if everybody had a checklist and they just went through it.
And our office does have a checklist. I created one, I guess it's almost been 15 years that I've been there, right when I started, of Rule 11 colloquy issues. And I think every attorney in our office uses that at Rule 11 proceedings. It's also on your website in our handbook, is that checklist. So, but yes, I agree that's often, there are a lot of holes in Rule 11 proceedings.
Thank you.
So, right. Thank you.
As always, thank you, Ms. Christensen. Mr. Wall, thank you. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will